Welcome back to the Ross Lair Podcast. We continue our conversations with Noel Cullerton about some of the world's greatest composers and musicians. Noel, you have Franz Liszt here. Could you tell me a little bit about him?
Franz Liszt, a Hungarian composer. He spent a lot of his life in Paris and then in Germany. But he was regarded as the big, bad, handsome man of classical music. He had a dubious reputation, let's say, and we'll explain why in a second. But by age of 9, he was already brilliant. His father died when he was 12, so he had to support his mother for the rest of his days. So whatever they say about him, he was very good to her. He became the best pianist in Europe at a time when there was a lot of great pianists around when he was in his 20s, and he toured extensively. He was the absolute superb showman at his concerts. Women used to become overwrought at us with the power of his performance and often fainted at his feet. It was a bit like Beatlemania. There was Listomania long before there was Beatlemania. And his concerts used to be full to the rafters wherever he went. He was an absolute superstar. In the middle of all this fame, he caused a major scandal by running off with a married woman to Switzerland, and for which they had 3 children. In the meantime, he continued to tour around Europe, sleeping with every woman who was willing to do so, and he had a great time. In marked contrast to this, his real ambition was to be a priest. And he never saw any great contradiction between his spirituality and his hedonistic lifestyle, let's say. After about 10 years of this, he was in his mid-30s, and the shine was going off the high life for him. He was getting tired of all this constant travelling. His mistress, whom he had run off with, was also getting sick of his constant bragging about his fame and his fortunes. She just had enough of this big, loud, egotistical man, and she left. But truth be told, he wasn't really heartbroken because he wanted a big change in his career. He had always composed, and he really wanted to do a little bit more of it. At 35 years of age, he gave up this life as a superstar. Superstar, a very brave decision, and decided he would go composing full time. In the meantime, needless to say, he had picked up another woman along the way. He came across a 28-year-old Princess Caroline Sin Wittgenstein was her name. Although she was a devout Catholic and had a daughter and was separated from her husband, Liszt lost no time in adding them to his list of conquests. Although in fairness to him, he was genuinely fond of this woman and he wanted to marry her. She was one odd creature now. She constantly smoked big black cigars and kept all the windows in the house shut because she had a pathological fear of fresh air. But anyway, he got a job as a music master in the city of Weimar. He was in charge of music for the city of Weimar in Germany. And the two of them moved in together. Ah, sure, he was in his element in the city. He conducted lots of music, attracted all the great composers of the day, and it was a great time for music in Europe. And they all came to Weimar to perform. He became the mecca for all the young composers. He also wrote an awful lot, and he is famous for writing what they called symphonic poems or tone poems. And that's just a name for symphonies that were based probably on a work of art, art that he liked. Usually they were books or pictures maybe, but mostly books. He's probably most famous for one of them, which is called the Prelude, and it's a lovely piece of music. However, there's all the great times, but all good things come to an end. The conservative people of Weimar were getting a little bit fed up of him. One, he was probably costing a fortune at bringing all these concerts in and the city had to pay for. But as well as that, they were very conservative and they didn't like the arrangement that he had, that living together with a woman when they weren't married. Now, in fairness to him, the pair of them did their best to get married. He even appealed to the Pope. And he was on the verge of giving her an annulment from a previous marriage, but it all fell through. And after that, the pair of them drifted apart. He resigned from his job in Weimar and ended up his days as an abbot. He went back to Rome, and his old ambitions to be a priest resurfaced. But now, no way could they ordain him with his history. But they did become an abbot, and he spent the rest of his time teaching, composing the odd bit, and teaching. He often gave lessons for free. There are now people that still claim to be teachers that learned from Liszt, fifth generation Liszt or sixth generation Liszt, to call themselves. He had such an impression on the people he taught that when they taught, they say, well, I was taught by Liszt. And we still have people, very fine piano players, that reckon they came from a long list of people that were taught by Liszt. So,
what age was he when he went into the monastery or
the end of his life? I haven't got it offhand, but he was quite elderly.
He was an old man.
Yeah, he was an old man. He lived a full life. And he wrote some really dynamic music, piano music especially.
Could you mention some pieces of his that you particularly love?
Well, there's a piece called Totentes, which he used the piano. He based around Dies Irae. Remember that Latin, the Dies Irae? He played music around that. And he really bangs the piano now. In fact, you'd have to stop it after a while. You'd afraid he'd going to break the piano. He bangs it so loudly. So it's absolutely wonderful music. But he wrote lots of... But if I was to play a piece, I'd play a beat called the Totentes.
That was the piece Totentanz by Liszt, played by the Berliner Philharmonie with Beatrice Beru on piano.
Noel, could you continue telling me about this man, Verdi?
Ah, yeah, Giuseppe Verdi. He was an Italian composer, great opera composer. He was born in Northern Italy in 1813. His father was an innkeeper, kept a pub, weren't well off. But a local aristocrat spotted the young chap's talent and he educated him. He turned around anyway and he married that businessman's daughter and they had two children. He wrote an opera and his career, things were going well. Then disaster struck. His wife and two children died within a year or another and he was absolutely devastated. He was in complete despair and he was in no mood at all to write operas. As luck would have it, an impresario had spotted this young fella and reckoned that he had talent and he kept at him to try one more opera. And believe it or not, they came across a story in the Old Testament, the Book of Nedzer. If you've read the Old Testament, you might have heard of it in the Book of Nedzer. But this fella had a script based on the story of Nebuchadnezzar, and he called this opera Nabucco. And he gave it to Verdi. And lo and behold, Verdi gradually took an interest in it. And he wrote this opera. And it turned out to be a magnificent success, Nabucco. That launched his career. And he wrote a succession of operas after that, almost one a year, and one was nearly more successful than the other. He was a phenomenal man. He wrote operas that were often inspired by writers, people like Victor Hugo, Lord Byron, but he always had a soft spot for Shakespeare. And when he was 30, he based an opera based on Shakespeare's play called Macbeth. I should point out that at the time, Italy was being governed by outside countries, and there was a big push on for Italian independence and unification. And Verdi was a nationalist. He believed passionately in that cause. And he wrote, in that first opera, Nabucco, he wrote a song, an aria. In operas we call songs arias. But he wrote a chorus called The March of the Hebrew Slaves. And if we've time at the end, we might play a snippet from Nabucco. But it almost became a national anthem to the insurgents. When he wrote Macbeth, the insurgents who were his friends weren't a bit impressed. They said, for God's sake, what are you writing about Scotland for? Why not write about Italy and help our cause? And in fairness to him, he took that to heart and he wrote lots of operas that had a sort of a nationalistic theme, and Verdi became a national hero. And he continued to write music all his life. He wrote Il Trovatore, La Traviata, Don Carlos, and Aida. He also met his wife through that Nabucco thing. But he became famous, not only in Italy, but all over Europe. But he got so well, he got very well off, and he got so well off that he went back to his hometown and he bought a farm, and he had a fine farm up in Busseto, up in northern Italy, and he loved farming. And he always said, until the day he died, that he much preferred to have been a farmer than a composer. He got more of a kick out of farming than he did out of composing. When he was 70, he was kind of retired, he was well off. But a friend of his, a fellow called Errico Boito, who was a young man, came to him. And he knew that Verdi loved Shakespeare. He just knew it. And he said, he came to him with a script. He had taken Shakespeare's play Othello, and he had knocked it down to about 4,000 lines. And he said, this would be a great opera. And Verdi told him to just on his bike. But eventually, Boito kept at him and eventually persuaded him to write. So the two of them went at it. And after 3 years, they were produced a brilliant opera called Othello. So it was just, for an old man, it was a great achievement. But old and sick, at that stage, Verdi certainly wanted to call it a day. But Boito wasn't letting him off the hook. He had produced another script based on Shakespeare's plays, The Merry Wives of Windsor and Henry V. And Verdi couldn't resist it. He had never written a comedy. He had written a comedy opera in his young days and it wasn't a success. So Boito knew how to put the hook. Use Shakespeare, tell him it was a comedy. And sure enough, he persuaded Verdi to go at it. And they went at it and they called the opera Falstaff. It was premiered when he was 80 years of age and it went on to be a great success. So to my mind, Verdi's place in the pantheon of great composers. Anytime you'd heard on the radio, Verdi's singing, they're in films and they're everywhere. They're the soundtrack of people's lives, Verdi's. If they want emotional songs, you go to Verdi.
If you were to be asked, what would be your favourite piece by Verdi, what would you say?
Oh, there's so many pieces, but I would say, if I was to play a piece, we'll take the March of the Hebrew Slaves from that Nabucco opera, because it's very inspiring. And it's as it became famous at the time for the Italian nationalists. But in fact, it stood the test of time. It's just a great rattling going chorus song.
Piece of music. That was Chorus of the Hebrew Slaves, taken from Verdi's opera Nabucco, conducted by Volker Harting.
Noel, in your second book, Classic Collections, you talk about Shostakovich. Could you tell me about him?
Shostakovich was a man who led a very difficult life, very much influenced by the politics that happened around him. He was 11 years old when the Russian Revolution occurred in 1917, and his family and he were great fans of the Russian Revolution. He was a great fan of the ideals of the revolution, and the early music that he wrote was accepted with great enthusiasm by the Bolshevik leaders. He became a poster boy for the revolution. He was a committed communist, make no mistake, he was a committed communist in those early days. But it was all too good to last. His second opera was one called Lady Macbeth of the Minsk District, and was written in 1932. A tough opera, difficult opera, but it was deemed a roaring success. It did very well wherever it played. Suddenly, without any warning at all, an attack came on him. He put on the opera in Moscow in 1936. And who turned up? Only Stalin himself. Stalin loved music, and he turned up in the audience. In the second act, Stalin upped and left in a fit of absolute temper. He had a face like thunder. And poor old Shostakovich knew Shostakovich was at the performance that night, and he knew he was in deep, deep trouble. And that trouble wasn't long in coming. 2 days later, an article appeared in the newspaper Pravda, you know, the official Russian newspaper, and it attacked the opera viciously and said the opera was, quote, a muddle, not music, and the entire performance was crude, coarse and primitive. Now, that was fairly damning stuff, and everybody knew that Stalin had written it. At that time, Stalin was all-powerful. The attack nearly finished him. He immediately became a persona non grata. His friends shunned him. His income fell by about 80%. His sister and husband were arrested. And at one stage, he was hauled off to the state prison and interrogated. Like, his life was in deep, deep trouble. But make no mistake, if Shostakovich was anything, he was resilient. He realised that if he was to survive and continue to compose music, he would have to be constantly aware of what the political wind was blowing, how the political wind was blowing around him.
I just want to ask you, sorry for interrupting, Noel, but what was in the music that was... Was it the words or...?
No, and the music was modern, and Stalin was old-fashioned, and he liked music that would uplift the Russian people. Kind of thing.
So there wasn't political ideals in it?
There wasn't political ideals in it. No, it wasn't. It was more... Stalin thought music should be used to sort of... He thought everything should be used to promote communism and the Soviet way of life. And he reckoned it wasn't it. It wasn't the kind of music he liked. He liked lovely pastoral music with violins playing and peasants out working in the fields very happily. And this was anything but that. He was deeply unhappy about the whole thing. So he knew what to do to survive. He adapted his music to suit the taste, the modern political taste at the time. The establishment liked what he was written, and he gradually rehabilitated himself, and he even won the Stalin Prize. He wrote a string quartet and he won the Stalin Prize for it. So, you know, he was on and up again. Then the Second World War broke out, and he and the government buried the hatchet. They had more important things to fight about. So he was an intense patriot. He loved his country, and he wrote lots of music that was patriotic, and he became one of the great heroes of the Russian people at the time. He was in Leningrad when the Nazis surrounded Leningrad, and the people suffered desperate hardship. They were bombed every day. They were dying in their hundreds and thousands. They were all hungry. And he wrote what they called his seventh symphony, called the Leningrad Symphony. And it was smuggled out of Russia. It was played in the Allied countries, and it almost became a symbol of the struggle against Nazis. And it was really highly thought of, and still is to this day. It went a little bit out of favour, but it's a tremendous piece of music. At the time, it was interpreted as being very anti-Nazi, and it became a calling card for the Allied forces and victory over the Nazis. But in fact, some would argue that the subtext of it was that he was also having a dig at Stalin, that he was every bit of an oppressor as Hitler was. But nonetheless, at the time, it was interpreted as to be against the Nazis.
Was his music actually used then as propaganda?
Oh, yeah. It's classical music and it's a long symphony. But when it was recorded in Leningrad, the city was under... They couldn't get an orchestra together. And the man that conducted it had an extreme difficulty getting enough people still alive. And they were hungry. They couldn't sit in their seats. They were so hungry for very long. It was, and then they deliberately did it that the bombs... They stopped bombing stopped while this actually recording was being made. Like, there's books written about this Leningrad Symphony. That it's a really very famous book. Anyway, when the war was over, the war was quickly forgotten, and business was, as usual, was restored. His symphonies, that was the seventh one he wrote during the war. His eighth and ninth symphonies were not well received at all. The authorities proclaimed that they contained ideological weaknesses, whatever the heck that was. And the hammer fell completely then in 1948, when he and lots of other composers, he wasn't the only one, were accused of having anti-democratic tendencies that were alien to the Soviet peoples. Whatever the heck all that meant. But that's the Russians, the communists came down really heavily against, there was a huge purge against all sorts of artistic people, not only just composers, but all sorts of artistic people. There was another composer, Prokofiev, which we could easily have talked about. He actually was born in Russia and left, but came back thinking that things had improved. Worst mistake he ever made. He had a dreadful life for the last years of his life. But anyway, poor old Shostakovich was back in the wars again. He lost his income, ostracised by almost everybody, and lived in constant fear of being arrested. There was nights, actually, he used to sit outside his door with his suitcase outside his flat, so when they came to arrest him, they wouldn't disturb the family from sleeping. That's the kind of constant danger that he was in. And afterwards, anyway, Shostakovich made a demeaning, grovelling, and very humiliating public apology, and he promised to try harder writing music more suitable for the Russians. He once again wrote music that he knew the establishment would approve of, and once again he survived. And in fact, he survived Stalin by 22 years. And the question is always asked, was Shostakovich a supporter or a puppet of the Soviet regime? Was he a communist? Did he really hate the communist system? Well, to me, I think he did what was necessary to survive, and he composed music in the best way he could. He somehow managed to placate a terrible government and yet write music that was both personal to him and hugely enjoyable and moving to the rest of us. The evidence suggests, to me anyway, that he was a brave man who managed and survived the ravages of Stalin's regime and became one of the greatest composers of the 20th century.
That was the tremendous finale to Shostakovich's Symphony No. 7, performed by the Philadelphia Orchestra, directed by Yan-Nick Nesey-Sekun.
Keep listening to TRP.